with Israel at war with its enemies, to protect innocent men, women, and children after the atrocities that took place on October 7th. There's another war raging. The war over truth. A propaganda war filled with misinformation, disinformation, lies, myths. And this war is raging all over the world. In the media, on campuses, for control of our minds, mind control, an information war. And it's only amplified with modern technology, where today we have access instantaneously, social media, all the platforms, streaming, what's true, what isn't true, both on a news and breaking news level, but also on perspective, on context. Who's the oppressor? Who's the oppressed? It's a war going on right in your mind, right in your family, right in your home. So what more appropriate way to address it is by discussing it directly, transparently, with sources that we can all verify, not subjective storylines presented by people with biases and prejudices. We all obviously are subjective, but still, as an intelligent people, there are ways to verify things. So please join me in this critical battle and war over the truth. The history of the Holy Land, truths revealed and myths dispelled. Hi, this is Simon Jacobson, and we'll be speaking about a critical topic with the war raging, Israel against its enemies, the history of the Holy Land, truths revealed and myths dispelled. This program is dedicated by Robin Blumenthal in loving memory of her dear grandfather, Shimon ben David HaKohen, and her uncle, David ben Shimon HaKohen. Friends, these are very challenging times. There's a war raging in the Middle East, Israel, against its enemies, Hamas, however you define the enemies, after the atrocities, the brutal atrocities perpetrated on October 7th, with over 1,400 people massacred in the most horrible way, innocent men, women, and children. A war that needs to be fought because innocent people have to be protected. Every war is sad, is bloody, has many casualties. And therefore, our prayers go out to all those on the front lines representing what is right, what is just, the values that we very cherish, the very values that we cherish. But there's another war being raged, another war being waged, another war raging, and that is the war for truth. What is true? There's no question that a big part of this battle is a propaganda war. Becoming more and more evident that the very attacks were meant to provoke reaction and meant to create and control public opinion. And today, with technology, social media, streaming at us every second, it's a war that's waging and raging all over the world. over our minds, over our hearts. Yes, control of the narrative. And there's so many contradictory stories, it's hard to make heads or tails. And this isn't a small matter, because this is going to impact both the results of this war and maybe for generations. So this is an opportunity, not just an opportunity. We are compelled, we're behooved to be able to separate fact from fiction, truth from myths. And it's our personal responsibility, first of all, to achieve that clarity, and secondly, for all those around us. This war is being waged on campuses, in the media, everywhere. And as the way things look, this propaganda war is just going to intensify. We see deliberate images meant to affect our thinking. Obviously, when you see children dying, you see hospitals demolished, you say and blame the ones who bombed it, which itself is up to debate. Remember last week's argument, completely based on myth, that Israel attacked the hospital. Then we find out the whole thing was not true, came from their own missiles. How many other stories are going to develop that are true and untrue? All meant to sway our thoughts and our opinions. So one part of this war that has to be waged is to clarify and separate in ways that can be verifiable, objectively, not by biased or prejudiced or hate-driven people, but by facts. So I want to tackle this head on, the history of this region of the Holy Land, the Promised Land, revealing truths and dispelling myths. Now you can say I'm biased as well, and I may be. Who isn't? We're all subjective human beings. So I'm not asking you to take anything that I say at face value. Verify everything, confirm everything. We've actually created on our website, meaningfullife.com/war in Israel, many articles and videos. For one of the purposes is to achieve clarity. It's very hard to fight a war without clarity. Winston Churchill famously said, in time of war, the truth is so precious, it's surrounded by an army of lies. And that's intentional. Every side wants to mislead, and there are decoys. It's called intelligence. You want to mislead the enemy, and you do it through lies and deception. That's how precious the truth is. But here it goes a step further, because much of this war and many aspects of the war is being fought in the arena of public opinion. So let me address questions that have come to me, that I hear, and I'll try my best to answer them in ways that I have researched. And as I said, check it out yourself. But don't come to any conclusions just because someone said so, including me. If you go to our site, you'll find there's a dialogue between actually a pro-Israel and pro-Palestinian conversation. And there are plenty of sources cited. That will be like backup, follow-up material if you wish to pursue this further. So let's begin, talk about the story of the Holy Land. Let's begin with that. The history of this region, the history of the Holy Land. There you have many narratives as well. And here's one of the first myths. I call it a myth, absolute myth. That the indigenous natives of the land are what some people call Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims, that have lived there for centuries. And the Jews in the 19th century and the 20th century began to move there and displace them. No different than the Europeans who came to the United States or to America and displaced the Indians, the indigenous natives of India, of America, as the Australians did to the indigenous natives, the Aborigines in Australia. That's the story. Is that true? Absolutely not. On several accounts. But first, let's spell it out. You hear, Israel occupied. And that's why they argue from the river to the sea, because it's all been occupied. And you find videos and narratives told about how the Jews displaced the olive groves of people living there, of a thriving commerce and economy, Palestinians. And slowly took over control and essentially kicked them all out. But there are a few million left and they want their land back. Sounds very logical, very rational, sounds very ethical actually. What's wrong with the story? It's absolutely not true. That's what's wrong. Firstly, it's not the Jews arrived in the 19th and 20th century. The Jews have been there from the beginning of time, long before there was Islam, long before Christianity was born, long before anything. How do we know that? Go to the Bible, one of the oldest books in history, a Bible that's accepted by the Christians and by the Muslims, and read. Read the book of Genesis. The book of Genesis that says that Abraham came from southeastern, what is today southeastern Iraq, and made his way to this land called Canaan. And God says to him, this is the land that I promise you and your children. Abraham purchased land. He wanted to make sure that he owns it. Then, to make a long story short, the Jews, because of a great famine, went down to Egypt. And they got stuck there and they were enslaved by the Egyptians. By the time they got out hundreds of years later and came back, which is the major story of the Bible, the 40 years that they traveled through the Sinai wilderness, they came back, they were displaced, occupied. Land that was bought with blood, sweat, and tears and money. And everyone knew it. But they thought the Jews stayed, the Jews left, that's it. And they had to go to war to reclaim their own homes. And they lived there for hundreds of years after that. And we have the story of the first temple and the second temple. The first temple destroyed by the Babylonians. And again, they expelled the Jews for a short period of time, 70 years. But some Jews remained in Babylon and other countries. Then they came back and rebuilt the second temple. Destroyed 420 years later by the Romans. And they exiled the Jews and they changed the name of the city of Jerusalem. They wanted to leave no memory. If you go to the tunnels under Jerusalem, you can actually see their efforts to destroy what Herod had built. He built a plateau. He built a plateau in order, because it was a mountain. They had to build the temple on a solid ground. So he built essentially a structure. And you can see it, how they tried to destroy the structure. There should be no remnant. But they couldn't. The Western Wall remained, as did others, besides the memories. They were talking now almost 2,000 years ago. And prior to that, another 1,800 years. It's the 19th century, it's not 20th century. We're talking about where anyone living in that region was even born. The Jewish people in an unbroken chain. And even when they were exiled by the Romans, some still remained. But not just that, Jews everywhere continued to pray east toward Jerusalem, toward Israel. Mention Israel and Jerusalem in every prayer. Next year in Jerusalem, the Shana Haba Yerushalayim, said at the end of every Passover Seder, said hundreds and every wedding ceremony, breaking a glass, remembering Jerusalem. You can check this out all on your own. As I said, don't take my word. It's thousands of years. So to say, create a myth that the Jews suddenly returned, that Jews suddenly came And the world had sympathy for them because of the Holocaust and other persecutions. And it was the Balfour Declaration and the UN vote that gave the Jews a homeland is absolute myth. If anything, you could say the Balfour Declaration and the UN confirmed something that was always historically known, at most. And even that, it's not, Israel did not begin in 1948. The land of Israel began 3,800 years ago. And if you want to add even stronger argument, the first commentary, the commentary on the first verse in the Bible, Rashi, Rab Shlomi Yitzchaki, lived around 1,000 years ago, quotes a medrash that comes from 2,000 years ago, that it says, why did God begin the Torah? Why does the Torah begin with God, in beginning God created heaven and earth? Why doesn't it begin with the mitzvot, with the commandments? The Torah was given with moral and ethical laws. So it says, because should there come a day where the non-Jewish world will say, you are thieves, you've stolen this land from us, the land of Israel. So here God says, I'm giving you preemptively what to respond. The response is, I created heaven and earth, and I gave earth to whom I want to. I gave earth to the entire nations of the world, and one piece I gave to my people, the Jewish people. One sliver. How did Rashi, how did the Medrash know there would be such an argument? Because this argument is going on for years. And it's more than just a territorial and geographic argument. It's a spiritual argument, which I'll talk about soon. Did other people also live in this part of the world? Well, listen, once the Romans exiled the Jews, you know, slowly some people ended up there. But there's been documentation how it always remained desolate. Some say because God has exiled his people, remain desolate. So there are people that live there. Correct. But Jews always lived there. Always. And it was always an aspiration. Some of the great leaders, Nachmanides, the Shalah, and many, many others made their way at the end of their lives from Europe or wherever it is that they lived, from Egypt, from the different countries, made their way and were buried and died in Israel, the land of Israel, the promised land, the holy land. The words, the promised land, the holy land, where'd those words come from? That's not 20th century language. That's not 19th century language. I know it makes some people uncomfortable, which we'll soon talk about, the Western world's academic biases on this matter. But we know those words, holy land, promised land. Everyone knows exactly what you mean when you say those words. So were there others, not Jews, living in the promised land, the holy land, let's say in the 19th century, the 18th century? Yes, the Ottoman Empire controlled it for a long period of time. And there were Arabs that lived there and Muslims that lived there. No one's denying that fact. But to deny that the Jews is a Jewish homeland, you could say everyone else are occupiers. And fine, God allowed that because of the people's sins. So he allowed others to occupy the holy promised land, but never took away that land from the Jewish people. So when they began making their way, they're just going home. Were there some injustices that happened? I'm sure that things happened. But to make a claim that these are occupiers, colonizers, colonialization, is a complete myth. But I'll take this a step further. There was never such a thing called Palestine. There was never such a country called, and people called Palestinians. And I'm going to quote now, not Torah sources. I'm going to actually read. I'd like to read to you. This is a quote that goes back to 1977, March 31st. The Dutch newspaper, Trouw, I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, published an interview with the PLO's executive committee member, Zahir Mussain. Quote, the Palestinian people does not exist. The creation of a Palestinian state is only a means for continuing our struggle against the state of Israel for our Arab unity. In reality, today, there's no difference between Jordanians, Palestinians, Syrians, and Lebanese. Only for political and tactical reasons do we speak today about the existence of a Palestinian people. Since Arab national interests demand that we posit the existence of a distinct quote-unquote Palestinian people to oppose Zionism. For tactical reasons, Jordan, which is a sovereign state with defined borders, cannot raise claims to Haifa and Jaffa, while as a Palestinian, I can undoubtedly demand Haifa, Jaffa, Beersheba, and Jerusalem. However, the moment we reclaim our right to all of Palestine, we will not wait even a minute to unite Palestine and Jordan. Okay. Quote one, number one. Let me go to another quote, if I may. Again, you can check these out on your own. This is a quote from Joseph Farah, an Arab-American journalist. Quote, isn't it interesting that prior to the 1967 Arab-Israeli war, there was no serious movement for a Palestinian homeland? Well, Farah, you might say, that was before the Israelis seized the West Bank and Old Jerusalem. That's true. In the Six-Day War, Israel captured Judea, Samaria, and East Jerusalem, but they didn't capture those territories from Yasser Arafat. They captured them from Jordan's King Hussein. I can't help but wonder why all these Palestinians suddenly discovered their national identity after Israel won the war. The truth is that Palestine is no more real than Never Never Land. The first time the name was used was in 70 AD, when the Romans committed genocide against the Jews, smashed the temple, and declared the land of Israel would be no more. From then on, the Romans promised it would be known as Palestine. The name was derived from the Philistines, a Goliathian people conquered by the Jews centuries earlier. It was a way for the Romans to add insult to injury. They also tried to change the name of Jerusalem to Elia Capitolina, but that had even less staying power. Palestine has never existed. This is all his quote. Before or since, as an autonomous entity, it was ruled alternately by Rome, by Islamic and Christian crusaders, by the Ottoman Empire, and briefly by the British after World War I. The British agreed to restore at least part of the land to the Jewish people as their homeland. Restore. There's no language, quote, continue the quote, known as Palestinian. There's no distinct Palestinian culture. There has never been a land known as Palestine governed by Palestinians. Palestinians are Arabs, indistinguishable from Jordanians, another recent invention, Syrians, Lebanese, Iraqis, etc. Keep in mind that the Arabs control 99.9% of the Middle East lands. Israel represents 0.1% of the landmass. But that's too much for the Arabs. They want it all. And that is ultimately what the fighting in Israel is about today. That's what he writes. Greed, pride, envy, covetousness. No matter how many land concessions Israelis make, it will never be enough. And finally, I quote Professor Bernard Lewis of Princeton, an eminent authority on the region. From the end of the Jewish state in antiquity to the beginning of the British rule, the area now designated by the name Palestine was not a country and had no frontiers, only administrative boundaries. It was a group of provincial subdivisions, by no means always the same, within a larger entity. So the alternative narrative is a very convenient one, but simply untrue. I want to add this. In 1948, when the partition took place, meaning when the UN partitioned and said this would be the Jewish, this would be given to the local Arabs living there, the Jews accepted. Came the state of Israel. The Arabs rejected it and went straight to war. As a matter of fact, it was the Arabs' countries surrounding the area that called for the natives living there, move out. We'll win the war, get out of the way, and then you'll all come back. Unfortunately, they lost the war. What were the Jews doing? The Jews were calling their neighbors and saying, stay here. Let us live in peace with each other. There's documentation of this. And this happened time and again. So this whole myth that has become like the story that so many people believe is just simply false. Check it out. Be open-minded enough to check it out. And if you have an alternative narrative with sources, please send them to me. And I say this right now as a Jew. We always wanted peace. We continue to want peace. As a matter of fact, this war, for us, on one hand, is self-defense and protecting the innocent that were massacred, and they would love to massacre if they had the opportunity to do so. But the war is a far bigger one. It's an ideological one. Will truth prevail? Will God prevail? Will goodness prevail? If indeed every Arab country and every Arab Muslim would lay down their arms and say, we want total peace, we want to live in peace, no call for the destruction of Israel, no call for the destruction of every Jewish man, woman, and child, no call for from river to sea, total, complete peace. Check it out, see what would happen. That alternative was never pursued. If the Jews laid down their arms, a point has been made. What you saw on Simchas Torah on October 7th would be, God forbid, mild in comparison to what the enemies would want to do. They didn't make a quota of 1,400. If they could, it would be 14,000, it would be 14 million if they're possible, God forbid. I don't even want to say the words, I already said them. If the Jewish people laid down their arms, if they laid down their arms and actually declared surrender and declared we want only peace, we change our constitution, no more state of war, no more call for destruction, you tell me what would happen. The second myth, well, maybe it's a part, is it's apartheid, occupation. Israel can cut off the water as they've done, electricity, water and other resources running to Gaza, and the same thing to what is called, they call the West Bank. West Bank of what, by the way? Jordan. That's what it's called. The only reason Israel has done that, because they have the ruling party has called for its destruction. What should Israel do? Should it kill everybody in Gaza? What America did to the Indians? What the Europeans did to the Indians? No, that's not what Jews do. That's not the belief. When you call for the destruction of your neighbor, the neighbor has only two options, either to kill you and go to war with you, or to protect itself. And part of protecting itself is not allowing you to build an army that can then destroy you. Here, without even having what they call the second two-state solution, without a second state, look what happened. Imagine there was a second state with people calling for your death. So the first thing we have to acknowledge is that the Arab and Muslim world, every one of them has to declare peace, absolute peace. No conditions, unconditional. Which teaches us another lesson in war. Look what happened at the end of World War II. Yes, the Allies had to destroy Berlin, Dresden, of course. Hiroshima, Nagasaki, many civilians were killed because they refused to give up. So the only solution was to destroy them completely as much as possible and then demand unconditional surrender. Why unconditional surrender? Why not conditional surrender? Let them save their face. Let them save face. Let them have some pride. Because if you allow the loser to feel there's even 1% hope, they will never go away. They have to be completely destroyed. Unconditional surrender, the winner. After what you've done, what you've perpetrated, the winner dictates the terms. And look today, 80 years later, Japan and Germany have been rebuilt into powerful countries, allies with the United States, with the allies, allies with Israel. How's that possible? They were such enemies. Because strength is what's necessary when there's evil. When something's done wrong, no, you don't compromise, you don't negotiate. Appeasement, as Churchill as well said, is feeding the crocodiles in the hope that you'll be eaten last. No, there's no room for that. That's a mistake which is not necessarily the time right now to discuss that Israel made in 1967 and 1973 and many times again, and look what happened. You let your guard down with a sworn enemy. Remember, a state of war does not mean that you're fighting all the time. It means that someone has declared war on you, and you never know when they're going to attack. That has never been resolved. There are countries that have a state of war with Israel. They just don't attack because they can't. The deterrence of the military of Israel or whatever it may be. But now you see they have. So we understand Israel is mightier. But still it's an enemy that now has unfortunately taken 1,400 lives and hundreds of hostages. And our hearts again, prayers go out to them. Now you'll say, well, look at this guy. He's, you know, completely pro-Israel. I'm pro-human being. I'm pro-God. I believe that God created every human being on this earth. And here's another myth in the divine image. Yes, Palestinians included, and Arabs included, and Muslims included, and Christians, and Buddhists, and atheists. Doesn't matter. One God created all of them. All of us. And Jews. And as such, we have to respect the dignity of life. That's what we believe. And I believe. So the myth that we want to kill anyone, God forbid, goes against the very principles. Even in the name of religion, we don't kill. On the contrary, you want to influence someone spiritually? Inspire them. Abraham, our great-grandfather, he prayed for infidels. He did everything possible through love. I'm not sure how some of his grandchildren took a very opposite approach in the name of religion. Abraham would be appalled if he saw this type of behavior. So we can discuss it, that it's, I don't want to call it misplaced, that's a mild word. It's an obscene distortion of religion if you can kill a child of God's. When I say a child, I mean every innocent man, woman, and child. Yet another myth. I understand their religious passions. And some people argue that the very fact that Israel is controlled by Jews, and this is yet another myth, it's not about displacement, it's because it's considered a desecration against Allah. Because the Muslims are the chosen people, and as long as anyone even controls one inch, it's a desecration. Because Allah wants the Muslims to control. This is the thinking of many, many people, more than you may imagine. But the Western world does not want to accept it's a religious war. The Western world does not want to hear about the Middle Ages. They thought that was the past. So it becomes down to this simplistic, childish approach that they're oppressed, and the Jews are the oppressors. Think of the irony. If you had to choose one people who've oppressed throughout history, more than anyone else, and the greatest minority of oppression are the Jews. They're also the only ones that lasted and continue to be oppressed. Whether you go back to the ancient Egyptians, or I mentioned the Babylonians and the Romans, and in between the Assyrians and the Greeks and the Persians and the Ottomans and the Crusaders, and then later the Spanish Empire that expelled and banished all the Jews in 1492. The pogroms, the Inquisitions, and the Holocaust. That Jews are now the oppressors is beyond me. And my heart goes out, literally, to every innocent civilian, whether it's in Gaza, whether it's in the West Bank, whether they are Muslim or Christian, or whatever faith or no faith. But then you start wondering, what means innocent? You know, 100 million Germans were not all murderers, but they were all complicit. The Nazi party was a minority, but they voted them in and they became the controlling party. Hamas is the controlling government in Gaza. So even if you say they're a minority, but did the people elect them? Are they supporting them? Are they protesting? Or you could say they're being terrorized by Hamas. That's possible. There are totalitarian regimes that terrorize their majorities. But why is that not being discussed? Instead, the myth, the story that Israel is doing what was done to them, they're killing children. That's not the story. The story is Israel's protecting innocent people. And yes, and Hamas is using the civilians, terrorizing them, that they can't even speak up. Using them as civilian shields. Where do you think their headquarters are? It's enmeshed, entangled. Obviously, that's the smartest thing to do for people like that. We never do such a thing. Who would put military headquarters under a hospital or an old age home or with their children, schools? But they do. So who's abusing their people? And then what about all the entire region? I quoted before. Let's say that these people living there have been living there. They're not Jordanians or Syrians at this point. Why are their brothers and sisters not absorbing them? Do they dislike them? Or are they using them as pawns? When close to 1 million Jews were displaced from Muslim countries and Arab countries in 1948, in those periods of time, what do you think happened to them? Israel absorbed them. Actually, that made Israel far stronger, interestingly. Why is no one talking about that? Why is that not part of the moral imperative here? When you put it all to pieces together, you're going to have a combination of serious anti-Semitism, which is irrational, but dresses up in all kinds of garments and arguments, falsehoods and myths. Am I saying that everything Israel does and every Jew has been perfect in history? Absolutely not. I'm sure crimes have been done. But the narrative, let's frame the narrative, the history of the Holy Land. What's a myth and what's true? That's what we're discussing. So you'll say, so what's the solution? I'll tell you, as a simple layperson, what I think is the solution. You cannot have peace if someone's calling for the death of every one of your citizens. The United States can't have a peace like that. Europe cannot have a peace. No one can have such peace. So that's a prerequisite. There's no negotiation around that. It's not like, if you stop calling for my destruction, I'll give you a gift. No. Let's get an equal level playing field. I live in my house. You want to live next door to me in peace? You need to stop calling for my destruction. That's a non-starter if that is not on the table. And that's across the board. If that can be done sincerely, and that's a question, of course, how do you prove sincerity? That can be done sincerely, and it's going to take a lot of work because I know some people that just don't believe that. I know they say Israel does not belong to the Jews. It belongs to us for religious reasons. Some use the distorted historical argument. But the religious reasons are the hardest one because you could say the religious reasons, it makes no difference if it's your homeland for 3,800 years. Now God wants us to have it. Well, you know what? So then you have an argument between the Bible and your version of what you want God to do. You want to live in peace, that has to be a level playing field. If you can prove sincerity on that level, and until then we have to obviously enforce it because we can't just trust someone will just come and tell me, yes, I wanted your destruction for now the last 75 years or last 700 years, and now I don't want destruction anymore. Let's just make peace. I wouldn't trust them, and we shouldn't trust them. But let's for argument, so therefore initially you need to have every deterrent possible, military and so on, to make sure they're sincere. But let's say, for argument's sake, sincerity. Let's make the people in Gaza rise up, eliminate Hamas, support the elimination of Hamas, meaning exposing where they are, where they're hiding. The hostages are released. And the Gazan people say, now we're at your mercy. Hamas is gone. What do you think will happen? If Gazans are serious, so elect a peaceful leadership that is sincere, prove that sincerity, and what do you think will happen? Israel will attack? Of course not. And if that sincerity is proven, fine. Build up your life. Would I give them a state? I would not make a state, because a state would just allow them the ability to rebuild a terrorist and military activities. That has to be proven. That's in time. Trust has to be built up. And Israel should declare once and for all, we tried everything, but you've remained our enemies. You still wanted to kill us, and you still kill us. From now on, it's the rule of law that rules this country. Meaning, in the United States, if somebody kills an innocent person or somebody doesn't want to abide by the laws of the land, what do? They deport him. That's what Israel should do. You want to live in peace here, you have all the rights. But if religious passions and distorted stories are going to, you think are going to dominate, and you're going to try to incite the anti-Semitic Gentile world, which millions of dollars are pouring in clearly to do that, that's not the way you're going to win this battle. So there are many other myths that we can talk about and truths, but I wanted to cover the main ones that are clearly being presented. And my goal, obviously, someone who's a hater and can't even hear what I'm saying, obviously I don't think I could change their mind. But my goal is I'm reaching out to you, an open-minded person. Maybe you have some biases, just as all of us have. But open yourself up, check it out, research it. I will reserve another video, a class or video talk about the academic circles of how they have been caught up in this propaganda war. And many of them are actually leading the way. I do believe it's based on anti-Semitism, which is always the scapegoat of history, a minority that's been successful. Who better than the Jews? Lightning rod. But it's masqueraded in all kinds of progressive language. We're protecting the oppressed. But why do you selectively choose the oppressed? Only when you decide they're oppressed. Or as George Orwell put it, they don't love the poor, they hate the rich. They don't love the impoverished, they hate the successful. For whatever psychological, distorted, thwarted thinking those people have. But we'll talk about that. There's more to talk about. So there's a war going on as well over the truth. And I hope I was able to shed some light. And I hope you're able to listen to it. And as I said, I am more than welcome, even a rebuttal, but not one that's just coming from emotional babble and psychobabble or the propaganda that's being perpetuated out there. Think it through. Look up sources. Let's engage in a conversation. There are ways to disagree in civil ways. I don't have to kill you. You don't have to kill me. We don't have to. Personality, character assassination is not necessary either. And hopefully we can shine light. And light and truth in darkness is just as powerful as the most powerful weapons. Because clarity gives you confidence. Clarity gives you direction. And I truly pray and hope that every human being, 8 billion people, I wish I could say it about the Hamas murderers, but they too were created in the divine image. But people can betray their destiny. They can betray themselves and their calling. But 8 billion of us should allow our divine image to shine forth and understand we may disagree, but it's harmony within diversity. We can be diverse, but we have harmony because we all are looking something greater than ourselves, not worshiping our interests. We're not worshiping our beliefs. That's ultimately what Abraham, yes, Abraham unites us all, the father of all nations. And we read about him now in these week's chapters in the Torah, in the Bible. The father of all nations, what did he advocate? What did he pioneer? Love, unconditional love, virtue, justice, the antithesis of self-interest, including religious self-interest, including religious distortions and fundamentalism. That's what he taught to all his children, Yishmael, Isaac, and then Jacob, and Esav. And ultimately, his teachings will prevail. What he was taught and what he taught will prevail. Hopefully faster than slower, and hopefully that all of us will be part of the unfolding drama that will lead to a personal and global peace and redemption. Thank you. This has been Simon Jacobson, meaningfullife.com/war in Israel for many resources where you can comment, feedback, thoughts. Please share with others. Our website, meaningfullife.com, our YouTube channel, please subscribe. And yes, my heart goes out to each one of you. We're all souls on this glorious journey. But part of our lives is also to shine light. But part of the life is also to deal with the darkness and to shine light in the name, if it's necessary, militarily. But above all, spiritually, the spiritual war. of clarity, hope, confidence, strength, that we will ultimately prevail. Thank you and be well.
This program is brought to you by the Meaningful Life Center. Please help us continue our programs. Make even a small contribution at meaningfullife.com/donate.